All right, welcome to the Street Cop Podcast. This is episode 2. More to come. Glad that everybody's back here. I'm glad you guys enjoyed episode 1 so far. Got a lot of great reviews having Tom Rizzo in. I'm solo today, but we will be having guests in the future. A lot of stuff planned. COVID's a little strange right now. But today, this is what we're going to cover. The top 10 most important U.S. Supreme Court cases that apply to everybody. I'll explain when it doesn't apply to you thus far. And I say thus far is just because I have found thus far these are the most imperative ones for all of us to know about. I'm going to explain them to you, and hopefully from there you'll really catch on to what we're talking about. So without further ado, here are the top 10 U.S. Supreme Court decisions that apply to police officers, law enforcement officers, namely in the field. Number one, probably the most important one that we've gotten, Terry v. Ohio. Terry v. Ohio is an interesting one, and what I want to implore everybody to do is actually read Terry v. Ohio, because a lot of decisions that come out of that. Terry v. Ohio is an interesting case, and it made a lot of decisions for us. If you actually run Terry v. Ohio against your state's case law, you're going to find more pertinent case law to what you're looking for in the field, because almost everything we talk about regarding Fourth Amendment when it comes to police work has something to do with Terry v. Ohio. So what did Terry v. Ohio said? It was a landmark case argued by the United States Supreme Court, which held that Fourth Amendment prohibition on unreasonable searches and seizures is not violated when a police officer stops a suspect on the street and frisks him or her without probable cause to arrest. If the police has a reasonable suspicion that the person has committed, is committing, or is about to commit a crime, and has reasonable belief that the person, this is the important part, may be armed and presently dangerous. Now, let me just iterate something. Some states say being armed is dangerous. For example, Texas, if I recall correctly, says, oh, I know I'm right, actually, because I just taught in Texas there. Texas actually says if you are armed, it's dangerous. Even if you have a knife and you discover a knife, it doesn't mean there's not more knives. So if you had a knife on somebody in Texas on a traffic stop, you're allowed to pat frisk them for your safety. Not the same in every state, but at a very minimum, we must have a belief that the person is armed and dangerous. And the investigative detention is affected when we even have a motor vehicle stop. So armed and dangerous. And armed equals dangerous in about half the states in the union. So that's an important one to know. A lot of people don't understand the concept of doing a pat frisk when it's authorized, a governmental intrusion upon the sanctity of one person's body. Now, I'm certainly not telling you if you find yourself in a safety situation to try to figure out if you have enough for a Terry frisk and it'll cost you your life. That's not what I'm imploring here. I'm saying understand when you're documenting the action that you take that there had to be some kind of danger factor. To know more about what was acceptable in your state, read your state's case law. A follow-up on that one, I got a little bonus material for all this stuff. Rawlings v. Kentucky. You know what, a lot of these come out of people who have constantly, over and over again, reached out to me and I hear the same questions. They said I couldn't do this. They said I couldn't do that. This guy thinks this. This girl thinks that. Our attorney thinks this. Our defense attorney thinks this. The judge said. But the bottom line is it comes down to the facts. And having this knowledge of case law, namely, I'm going to give, obviously, U.S. Supreme Court case law because it is the law of the land. It's where it starts. Just know that some states have parted ways with the decision of these cases. And what I mean by that is they've made it more restricted for the police. It's never less more restrictive or less restrictive for the police. It's always more. It can never be less. Rawlings v. Kentucky, Supreme Court, 1980. Where the petitioner's formal arrest followed quickly on the heels of a challenged search of petitioner's person, we do not believe it particularly important that the search preceded the arrest rather than vice versa. What does this mean in layman's terms? In order for somebody to be searched incident to arrest, you just had to have probable cause to arrest the person. You do not have to put handcuffs on first for make somebody officially under arrest. That's the truth. So if you're doing a search incident to arrest, the cuffs wouldn't have to be on first. You would just have to have enough probable cause to effect the arrest. Don't let people tell you that, oh, he wasn't under arrest. I just searched him into the arrest. You know, he didn't have the handcuffs weren't on him yet. Folks, it's scary. And the only thing that dispels these scary proclamations of misleading and misinformation is case law. Knowing it is highly important. Number two, Peyton v. New York. Peyton v. New York is a U.S. Supreme Court case concerning warrantless entry into private home in order to make a felony arrest. The court struck down a New York statute providing for such warrantless entries because the Fourth Amendment draws a firm line at the entrance to the house. absent exigent circumstances, that threshold may not be reasonably crossed without a warrant. The court did, however, specify that an arrest warrant, as opposed to a search warrant, would have sufficed for entry into the suspect's private residence if there had been reason to believe the suspect was in the home. So, people ask this question quite often. Hey, can we go into a house for a misdemeanor warrant? And the answer is, well, you would certainly check with your state's case law. According to the U.S. Supreme Court, you certainly may enter if you have reason to believe that the suspect was within the home. That is a big caveat you have to have there. What happened in Peyton was they had developed, just in a nutshell, probable cause. Like this man, I believe he committed, I didn't read it, I haven't read it in a while, but I believe it was had to do with a murder suspect of a gas station. They went and robbed a gas station, murdered the guy, they developed a probable cause to arrest him. And instead of going and typing a warrant, which they had time to do, there were no exigent circumstances to race over there. They had time to go get a warrant, but they didn't. They entered into the home without fresh pursuit. So don't get confused on fresh pursuit either. Fresh pursuit, where that felony language comes in, is a different story. We're talking about having a warrant in your hand and being able to enter into a private residence where the suspect lives. I'm going to clarify that with third parties in just a second. Let's read about Peyton just a tad. Last term we noted probable jurisdiction of these appeals in order to address that question. After hearing oral argument, we set the case for re-argument this term. We now reverse the New York Court of Appeals and hold the Fourth Amendment to the United States Constitution made applicable to the states by the 14th Amendment, citing Mapp v. Ohio and Wolf v. Colorado, prohibits the police from making warrantless and non-consensual entry into a suspect's home in order to make a routine felony arrest. So if you reverse that with a warrant or consensual entry, you'd be in good shape. Peyton v. New York continue. Finally, we note the state's suggestion that not only a search warrant based on probable cause believe the suspect is at home at a given time can adequately protect the privacy interest at that stake. And since such a warrant requirement is manifestly impractical, there need be no warrant of any kind. We find this ingenuous argument unpersuasive. I'm going to read a little further down. If there is sufficient evidence of a citizen's participation in a felony to persuade a judicial officer that his arrest is justified, it is constitutionally reasonable to require him to open his doors to the officers of the law. Thus, for Fourth Amendment purposes, an arrest warrant founded on probable cause implicitly carries with it the limited authority to enter a dwelling in which the suspect lives when there is reason to believe the suspect was within. When we say reason to believe is within, we know that we have to have some factual data, whatever it may be. But also, don't forget, we've had this discussion. If somebody has moved, let's say you have a one-year-old warrant, right? And it has their address on the warrant, but you've developed enough factual data to show that the person now resides at a different residence, you don't have to go back to the court and have them recall the old warrant and change the address on it. You just have to believe that that is now the primary residence of the person who's listed in the warrant. The address does not have to match as long as you believe the suspect's house from which you're going to is where this person resides. Not just visiting, not the home of a third party. We're getting to that in a second. Oh, here we are. Stiegold versus the United States. It was the U.S. Supreme Court which held that based on the Fourth Amendment, a police officer may not conduct a warrantless search of a third party's home in an attempt to apprehend the subject of an arrest warrant absent consent or exigent circumstances. So if you have consent or exigent circumstances, certainly you'd be in good shape, you'd be in standing to make the warrantless entry. But just the warrant alone will not allow you to go into his cousin Phil's house if he happens to be staying with him for a couple days. You'll need to secure the residence and apply for a search warrant via telephonically or in person, whatever it may be, and then have a search warrant for the home to go and enforce the arrest warrant for the person listed on the arrest warrant. So if it's their home, you can go in if you have reasonable belief that they're inside. If it's not, and it's somebody else's home, you would need consent, exigent circumstances, which could be like they're trying to flee out the back window, they're getting a weapon, they're destroying evidence, they're trying to escape, whatever it may be, that would give you exigent circumstances. Or consent, you could knock on the door and say, hey, we know Steve is inside. Can we come in and arrest him? Michigan v. Summers, a follow-up on that one. I know I said I had 10 of these, but these are all not the most important, but follow-ups to the most important. That holding is relevant today. If the evidence that a citizen's residence is harboring contraband is sufficient to persuade a judicial officer that an invasion of the citizen's privacy is justified, it is constitutionally reasonable to require that a citizen to remain while officers of the law execute a valid warrant to search his home. Thus, for Fourth Amendment purposes, we hold that a warrant to search for contraband founded on probable cause implicitly carries with it the limited authority to detain occupants of the premises while proper search is conducted. If you happen to go to a house and develop probable cause and need a search warrant, you can also ask folks to step outside and secure them while we apply for a search warrant. We're not going to let people roam around a house. Number three, Delaware v. Prowse. Delaware v. Prowse was a U.S. Supreme Court case in which the court held that the police may not stop a motorist without reasonable suspicion to suspect a crime or illegal activity to check their driver's license and auto registration. So what does this mean? The prerequisite for a motor vehicle stop could be probable cause, but at a very minimum, it's reasonable suspicion. Let me give you an example. In the state of New Jersey, we have cell phone laws. I think it's 3496.7. I don't know. It's been a while. What the cell phone law says is that you cannot have a cell phone in your hand, you cannot text and drive, and you cannot talk and drive. You must have a hands-free device. However, there is a caveat. What it means is there's an exception to the rule. The exception is if you are calling in an emergency or dealing with some kind of emergency, it is constitutionally permissible in the state of New Jersey, according to the statute, to use your cell phone. So let's say Officer Stevenson is on the side of the road and sees John coming down the street talking on his cell phone. Officer Stevenson now has reasonable suspicion to stop and investigate why John is on his cell phone. When he walks up to the car, John says, "Sorry, I know I'm on my phone, but I'm literally calling in a car that hit a tree about a half mile back." He says, "I'm on the phone with your emergency dispatch. Would you like to speak to your operator?" We had enough reasonable suspicion to stop John, but we do not have probable cause to issue the summons because he's validly using his cell phone here in the state of New Jersey. So what if we walked up in that car and we smelled the odor of marijuana? I mean, it's as of 11/9/2020 today, which we just got legalized marijuana here. We'll see how that unfolds. But let's say right now, would you still be constitutionally permissible to or permitted to hold John there and now search his car? Yes, of course you would, because you had reasonable suspicion to stop the car. And that happened within the time frame while you were investigating the motor vehicle violation that you observed. So Delaware v. Prowse says that's the minimum requisite. So make sure when you're talking about making a motor vehicle stop, we commonly coin this phrase of, what was your PC for the stop? Well, it might have been PC, but it also might have been reasonable suspicion. So let's use the right language. Delaware v. Prowse. A patrolman in a police cruiser stopped an automobile, occupied a respondent, and seized marijuana in plain view on the car floor. Respondent was subsequently indicted for illegal possession of controlled substance. After hearing a respondent's motion to suppress the marijuana, the patrolman testified that prior to stopping the vehicle, he had observed neither traffic or equipment violations nor any suspicious activity, and that he made the stop only in order to check the driver's license and the car's registration. Except where there is at least articulable reasonable suspicion that a motorist is unlicensed or that the automobile is not registered or that either the vehicle or an occupant is otherwise subject to a seizure for a violation of law, which includes traffic law, stopping an automobile or detaining the driver in order to check his driver's license and the registration of the automobile are unreasonable under the Fourth Amendment. So just to throw this out there, if you knew somebody's license was suspended and you saw them driving, well certainly that wouldn't be an issue. Okay? Number four, Heibel versus the Sixth District Court of Nevada, Humboldt City, U.S. Supreme Court, 2004. Reasonable suspicion is the constitutional prerequisite for compelling identification. Our decisions make clear that the questions concerning a suspect's identity are a routine accepted part of many Terry stops, citing United States v. Hansley. The ability to briefly stop and ask questions or check identification in the absence of probable cause promotes a strong governmental interest in solving crimes and bringing an offender to justice, citing Hayes v. Florida, 1985. If there are articulable facts supporting a reasonable suspicion that a person has committed a criminal offense, that person may be stopped in order to identify him, to question him briefly, or detain him briefly while attempting to obtain additional information. A brief stop of a suspicious individual in order to determine his identity or to maintain the status quo momentarily while obtaining more information may be most reasonable in light of facts known to the officer at the time. So, what does this mean? In a motor vehicle setting, in order to compel identification, we have to have a reasonable suspicion of some kind of crime. It could be the odor of marijuana, whatever, or a crime in progress, or you might see something in plain view or plain smell. using one of your five senses, or the person, the passenger, committed a motor vehicle offense. Could be ashing out the window, which is considered littering. You could be not wearing your seatbelt. Then we'll have the ability to compel identification. We want to use that ability to compel identification to achieve a larger law enforcement objective, which is to be able to check people for warrants, because you'd be surprised who's trying to hide out in the back of cars. So, and not wearing the seatbelt's not realizing they have to. So, let me just be clear about when you're compelling identification from somebody, the court said they have to give you enough information for you to be able to identify them. So if you commonly say to somebody, hey, I need your ID, and they say to you, well, I have my ID, I don't want to give it to you, but I'll tell you who I am, then that's fine. We don't have to play the game of, I'm not going to be going down this road with you. What I could also tell you is, if it's common for you to request somebody's social security number, which we know is important if you've taken our training, and they don't want to give it to you, and the name and date of birth is enough for you to get identification on the person and confirm who they are with their picture and the MDT, well, look, then you're going to be in good shape. Do they, and that's that. So I'm going to move forward to the next one. Number five, a big one. And by the way, this is in no particular order, so don't think that I chose these and select these from 1 to 10. No particular order. Number five, Brenlin v. California, 2007. A traffic stop entails a seizure of the driver, even though the purpose of the stop is limited and the resulting detention is quite brief. This stop also entails a seizure of every passenger of the vehicle along with the driver. Let's read a little bit about Arizona v. Johnson, which is a follow-up, citing Brenlin. At Arizona v. Johnson, 2009, from the U.S. Supreme Court, for the duration of the traffic stop, we recently confirmed a police officer effectively seizes everyone in the vehicle, the driver and all passengers, citing Brenlin v. California, 2007. Accordingly, we hold that in a traffic stop setting, the first Terry condition, a lawful investigatory stop, is met whenever it is lawful for police to detain an automobile and its occupants pending inquiry into a vehicular violation. The police need not have, in addition, cause to believe that any occupant of the vehicle is involved in criminal activity. To justify a pat-down of the driver or passenger during a traffic stop, however, just as in this case of a pedestrian reasonably suspected of criminal activity, the police must harbor reasonable suspicion that the person is subjected to the frisk is armed and dangerous. The last portion of Arizona v. Johnson, in sum, as stated in Brenlin, a traffic stop of a car communicates to a reasonable passenger that he or she is not free to terminate the encounter with the police and move about at will. If you want to know what your state said, if you have particular cases to your state, you could take Brenlin v. California, you could take Arizona v. Johnson, and you could run checks against your state regarding what cases you have and them adopting the federal standard. I have only found one state so far, maybe two out of the 50 in this union, that are not following the case law and the ruling found in Arizona v. Johnson and Brenlin v. California. So that's a big common myth that we hear. People are going to police academies. They've got instructors who have no clue what they're talking about. You've got all these people out there who think they're professionals. Don't get duped and fooled by somebody's title or their claims and certificates on their walls and blah, 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 blah. Make sure people know what they're talking about and they're citing the law from which they are speaking. It is important that we begin to train properly so we know how to perform this job properly, so we are not violating anybody's rights and we're not letting bad people walk away. We have the ability to hold on to them and compel identification. Number six, an oldie but a goodie, Pennsylvania v. Mims, 1997. Against this important interest, we are asked to weigh the intrusion into the driver's personal liberties occasioned not by the initial stop of the vehicle, which admittedly justified, but by the order to get out of the car. We think that this additional intrusion can only be described as de minimis, which means very minimal. The driver is being asked to expose to view very little more of his person than is already exposed. The police have already lawfully decided that the driver shall be briefly detained. The only question is whether he shall spend that period sitting in the driver's seat of his car or standing alongside of it. Not only is the insistence of the police on the latter choice not a serious intrusion upon the sanctity of the person, but it hardly rises to a level of petty indignity. What is at most a mere inconvenience cannot prevail when balanced against legitimate concerns for officer safety. So if you read Pennsylvania versus Mims, they go into why we are allowed to have people or order people outside of cars on traffic stops is because it's a safety issue. The courts have recognized that motor vehicle stops are inherently dangerous. And people, while sitting in their car, are in control of the vehicle and within arm's reach of a weapon. If you've seen the tactic of police officers putting people in the front seat of their car to conduct interviews as well, it's because of the same issues. We've already analyzed this with our legal expert. Shout out to Zachary Miller from Street Cop Training. He is a savage. We are thankful to have him. He's a wonderful instructor. He's a savant when it comes to case law, and he really knows how to break it down and give it to everybody perfectly. And it's never questioned. You don't have to question him. He's just that good. And he agrees that that is 100% constitutionally justified. And we've seen it in a lot of states where they try to challenge the front seat interview, and the states have said, no, it's the same thing. Now, a backseat interview is very different because now you're getting to a possible illegal detention, de facto arrest, or lawful. It depends. So that's why. Follow-up to Pennsylvania v. Mims is Maryland v. Wilson. In 1997, you know what? Let me go back for a second. I thought the Pennsylvania v. Mims thing sounded strange. It was 1977. That's why I thought it was an oldie, but a goodie. I had a typo on my paper here. 1977 was Pennsylvania v. Mims. 1997, 20 years later, in this case, we consider whether the rule of Pennsylvania v. Mims, that a police officer may, as a matter of course, order the driver of a lawfully stopped car to exit his vehicle, extends to passengers as well. We hold that it does. So what they say in 1997 is, look, if you're asking the driver out of the car, well, then asking the passenger out of the car is the same. It's the same constitutional requisite. Now, you must check your state's case law. Not every state agrees with this. For example, in New Jersey, we have to have something called a heightened caution to get passengers out of a car. It is less than reasonable suspicion and more than just a hunch. So right in there, that's where we differentiate in New Jersey from the U.S. Supreme Court. Not a hard thing to achieve, right? If you're stopping vehicles and you're suspecting criminality, well, clearly you're going to have enough, according to New Jersey, to have passengers step out. But if you are, this is just for New Jersey, if you are stopping vehicles and it's for random speeding violations, there's no criminality being seen or experienced, well, certainly we're not going to be asking people to step out of cars. Number seven, Berkemer v. McCarty. Good one. And again, these were hand-selected because a lot of people are spreading nonsense, banter, misinformation. And make sure you're not somebody who's part of the problem. Make sure you're part of the solution. So if you're going to open your mouth and speak about things and they're contrary to what the law actually says, I hope you read it. Right, I hope you read what you were supposed to read before you open your mouth. Berkemer v. McCarty. Here's what they said. Routine questioning of motorists detained pursuant to traffic stops is not custodial interrogation under Miranda. What does that mean? Miranda is triggered when you have questioning and custody, but a traffic stop is not custody. An arrest is custody. And every state says a little bit different times of when custody is actual custody. But what I can tell you is when somebody is actually under arrest is when you will actually have custody. They did say, though, Miranda applies to custodial interrogations that involve even minor traffic offenses. Once somebody's under arrest, no matter what it is, once they're in handcuffs, and if you're going to subject them to interrogative questioning, I'm not talking about booking procedures. I'm talking about asking them questions designed to elicit an incriminating response or confession will require you reciting Miranda to them prior to that. Out of Berkemer v. McCarty. While still at the scene of the traffic stop, Williams asked respondent whether he had been using intoxicants. Respondent replied that he had consumed two beers and smoked several joints of marijuana a short time before. Respondent's speech was slurred, and Williams had difficulty understanding him. Williams thereupon formally placed respondent under arrest and transported him in the patrol car to the Franklin County Jail. That questioning was permitted. At the jail, the respondent was given an alkoholizer test to determine the concentration of alcohol in his blood. The test did not detect any alcohol whatsoever in the respondent's system. Williams then resumed questioning respondent in order to obtain information for inclusion in the State Highway Patrol Alcohol Influence Report. Respondent answered affirmatively a question whether he had been drinking. When then asked if he was under the influence of alcohol, he said, I guess, barely. Williams next asked respondent to indicate on the form whether the marijuana he had smoked had been treated with any chemicals. In the section of the report headed remarks, respondent wrote, no angel dust or PCP in the pot. That was questioning that was entitled to having Miranda protections. That was suppressed. So the first one was good. The second one was suppressed. You have to know when Miranda kicks in. If you're a police officer and you're not reading Miranda regularly, it's a good habit to get into because it is a nice safety net you put on things. If you happen to get into questioning and you don't realize your questioning sounds like it is investigative. Number eight. United States v. Sharp, another one where we're dispelling myths and rumors regarding time limitations with investigative detentions. In assessing whether a detention is too long in duration to be justified as an investigative stop, we consider it appropriate to examine whether the police diligently pursued a means of investigation that was likely to confirm or dispel their suspicions quickly, during which time it was necessary to detain the defendant. See Michigan v. Summers. A court making this assessment should take care to consider whether the police are acting in a swiftly developing situation. And in such cases, the court should not indulge in unrealistic second guessing. We reject the contention that a 20-minute stop is unreasonable when the police have acted diligently and a suspect's actions contribute to the added delay about which he complains. The judgment of the Court of Appeals is reversed and the case is remanded for the further proceedings consistent with this opinion. You know what's funny? People will hear this 20-minute thing and they'll know it from this case, but they'll say just the opposite. Oh, you got 20 minutes on a traffic stop. Literally, every single day when I hear the nonsense that comes back to me, the things that are being talked about in the field, the advice they're receiving from coworkers, supervisors, prosecutors, it is terrifying. And I just couldn't sit by and watch this shit anymore. You know what I mean? It's just so crazy that nobody knows what the hell they're talking about. So that's what we're here for. Number 9, Wyoming v. Houghton. When the police have probable cause to believe an automobile contains contraband or evidence of a crime, they may search the entire car, including the contents of a passenger's personal belongings that may be capable of holding the object of the search. With probable cause, there's no right or claim to privacy within the automobile. When there is probable cause to search for contraband in a car, it is reasonable for police officers, like customs officials, in the founding era to examine packages and containers without a showing of individualized probable cause for each one. A passenger's personal belongings, just like the driver's belongings or containers attached to the car like a glove compartment, are in the car, and the officer had probable cause to search for contraband in the car. This kind of piggybacks off of United States v. Ross. Ross says, 1982, U.S. Supreme Court, the court held that a warrantless search of an automobile stopped by police officers who had probable cause to believe the vehicle contained contraband was not unreasonable within the meaning of the Fourth Amendment. The court in Carroll, when they say Carroll, that's United States v. Carroll, 1925, that's the indoctrination of the automobile exception to the written warrant requirement, did not explicitly address the scope of the search that is permissible. In this case, we consider the extent to which police officers who have legitimately stopped an automobile and who have probable cause to believe that contraband is concealed somewhere within it may conduct a probing search of compartments and containers within the vehicle whose contents are not in plain view. We hold they may conduct a search of the vehicle that is as thorough as a magistrate could authorize in a warrant particular describing the places to be searched. So some things here to think about. One, if somebody's in a vehicle and they have a backpack or a pocketbook or any kind of personal belongings and there's probable cause to search the car, this is not a consent search. You have automatic right to search those items. People will ask, hey, can we search the people? It depends what state you're in. For example, Illinois says yes. New Jersey says yes. But other states say no, like Maryland. Now, also, don't forget this isn't a consent search. In a consent search, a police officer will need the consent of the property from who the people, from which it belongs to the person. So for example, if you have a passenger in a vehicle and you get consent from the driver, absent discovering probable cause, you would have to ask a passenger for their permission to search their own personal property. Hopefully that makes sense. People get confused on this one, and we're trying to clarify that. But if somebody's personal belongings are in the vehicle, this is the same thing for a safe. If you find a safe in the trunk of a car and you have a canine hit, for example, and it alerted for the presence and the odor of narcotics, you'd be authorized in prying that safe open. Again, make sure you check your local case law, the state that you're in. You don't have to worry about the district you're in. Everybody always brings up, oh, the 9th district, oh, the 7th district, oh, the 5th district. It really has little relevance. The only time that district court is binding and not persuasive is when we see it rectifying or clarifying an issue that began at the state. Other than that, it generally deals with federal case law. For most police officers who are not federal police officers, this is not going to be applicable to you. U.S. Supreme Court is applicable to everybody. That was number 9. Let's go into number 10 here. Number 10. One of my favorites, one that's commonly misconceived, and that's abandoned property. What does abandoned property say under Texas v. Brown, 1983? An object may be considered to be in plain view if it can be seized without compromising any interest in privacy. Since seizure of an object threatens only the interest in possession, circumstances diminishing that interest may justify exceptions to the Fourth Amendment's usual requirements. Thus, if an item has been abandoned, neither Fourth Amendment interest is implicated, and neither probable cause nor warrant is necessary to justify seizure. So if somebody abandons property, let's say you're in a foot pursuit, and they toss a bag to the right, is that abandonment? Well, sure, maybe. Depends what state you're in. For example, in Wisconsin, if somebody flees from a vehicle in Wisconsin, if somebody flees from a vehicle, they are said to abandon the vehicle, allowing police officers to search it, which I find very interesting. But that's the Wisconsin Supreme Court has said. Now, it depends what state you're in. You may want to take extra caution. If you happen to apprehend the person, you would request for consent to search that disregarded item. If they say they don't know whose it is or it's not theirs, well, then certainly it is open season. Before you actually open that bag or that box or that item, what I would do is make sure I document that I scanned the outside looking for evidence of ownership before I accessed it. Because if it had evidence of ownership on it, we would want to contact the owner and ensure that we have vetted properly that the item is truly abandoned. And bonus feature today, I threw one in at the end because it's a cool one. And it didn't make the top 10, but it certainly is an important one. It has to do with pretextual stops, and it's Wren versus United States. A pretextual stop is based on motives unrelated to the express reason for the stop. The court said the observation of the traffic violation provided the constitutional justification for the stop. A police officer's ulterior motives will not serve to invalidate police conduct that is constitutionally justified. You could also read Arkansas v. Sullivan, which they tried to challenge the pretextual stop, and the court said it's a very important part of law enforcement today. It is a important tool where it's not based on color, creed, religion, age, or any bias reason, but factors, training, and experience that leads a police officer, even on a hunch, to think that the person they had just seen in a motor vehicle is committing or is about to commit a crime. They may find a motor vehicle violation to affect that stop, and it's paramount. The things that we're finding on these traffic stops, it is paramount that police officers can perform in this manner in order to deter crime, because when we can check on and check into looking into something on a traffic stop that we consider to be suspicious, it's amazing what we discover. And at very minimum, you'd be shocked that you'd be protecting the citizens of the United States, namely our children, from predators out there, because they will also give away some tells when they're engaged in the activity of targeting your children. You will have the same kind of experience, and somebody may be going to shoot up a school or a business. And if we as police officers can spend our time trying to disrupt that just once, you're going to find other things along that path. You're going to find drugs and guns and people who are wanted and crime, theft. You're going to find all sorts of crime associated with those motor vehicle stops. But the ones that we're most proud of are the ones that we really disrupt and save lives. So hopefully you enjoyed episode 2 of the Street Cop Podcast. I am done. Next time we do a podcast, and it's the one formal here, on the microphones, in the studio here at Street Cop Training in New Jersey, we will have a very special guest for you. Without further ado, please join our Facebook group, streetcop.com. Oh, let me back this up. I screw this up all the time. Our website is streetcop.com. Our Facebook group is facebook.com/streetcoptraining. We also have an Instagram page. Follow us on Instagram. Rate us on iTunes. Give us a good rating out there if you like what you're hearing. And tell your friends. We don't ask any money for this. We're not charging anything for anybody to hear this. If you like what you're hearing and you're finding value, then tell your friends, hey, you know what? You should listen to these guys. You should check out their Facebook group. If you're a non-cop listening to this and you're trying to get into our Facebook group, we vet all people who are trying to gain access to that. Not that we're doing anything that's unquestionable or questionable. What we are doing is to ensure the integrity of us to be able to speak freely without the criticism of people who do not understand what they're talking about and want to portray their opinions in an arena where they have no business, much like 99% of the world in everything, in every facet, in every subject. So without further ado, if you need me, you can reach out to me on any of those platforms. If you have any questions, anything you want to hear us cover on the podcast, be certainly happy to do that for you. I appreciate everybody's continued support as we grow to be the largest police training company in the country. Thank you all for being with me. Thank you for listening. Peace.